From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, strange rituals. Here's what's happening. Tropical Storm Harvey bore down on eastern Texas and Louisiana, bringing the catastrophic downpours that paralyzed the U.S. energy hub of Houston with record rainfall and drove tens of thousands of people from their homes. The storm that first came ashore on Friday near Corpus Christi, Texas, as the most powerful hurricane to hit Texas in more than 50 years, has now killed at least 37 people and forced at least 30,000 people to flee to emergency shelters. Damage has been estimated at tens of billions of dollars, making it one of the costliest U.S. natural disasters. And the Houston police chief said that he is not going to tolerate criminals taking advantage of people in the community during such a devastating time. He and his officers have arrested looters since Sunday, and they continue to do so. Howard Bloom, the critical thinker, of course, and noted author with us. Howard, why do people loot during catastrophes?
Well, here's the deal. We keep hearing anecdotal reports of looting in Houston in the wake of the hurricane, and they're very disturbing. For example, the Houston Chronicle reports that burglars armed with a brick broke into a Walgreens near Brays Bayou and stole money from three cash registers, plus liquor and packs of Newport cigarettes. And as many as 20 looters, we are told, broke into a Fiesta Mart on Interstate 610 to nab cash and cell phones. But the fact is that Hurricane Harvey did not bring out the rampant crime you might expect. In fact, it had the opposite effect. It made Houston citizens more generous. Now, that may sound hard to believe, but here are the facts. Houston has one of the highest crime rates in America, twice America's average rate of crime. Normally, Houston has 340 crimes a day. In other words, in the five-day period of Hurricane Harvey, there would normally be 1,700 crimes in Houston. Let me repeat that, 1,700 crimes. But in fact, as of 6:31 this afternoon, just a few hours ago, only 40 looters had been arrested. Only 40. Despite the fact that the police were on high alert for three different crimes, robberies, price gouging, and scam artists. Now, price gougers and scam artists were, in fact, Houston's biggest problem. Mm-hmm. Folks who claimed to be reputable contractors were going door-to-door, we're told, to find a sucker. Some merchants were asking outrageous prices for scarce goods. In one case, a store owner charged $99 for a case of water, and some gas stations were selling fuel for up to $10 a gallon. And it was reported that men approached homes, knocked on doors, said they were with the government, showed phony credentials, ordered evacuation, then plundered the empty houses. But here's the bottom line, and it's a very strange one. Only 40 suspected looters have been arrested, but the Texas Attorney General's office has received 500 complaints against price gouging. There is a race card being played here. Looting is a crime we often associate with blacks. Crimes like price gouging and con artistry we usually associate with whites. In the midst of this hideous flooding, it's not black crimes that Houston is suffering from. It's white crimes, middle-class crimes, and something more. This is the most important of the things that this catastrophe is revealing. Hurricane Harvey is inspiring a public spirit, a desire to save others, to save your family, and to save your neighbors. Even the Cajun Navy, the men with boats from Louisiana who've come to Houston to save Texans, are motivated by public spirit. The people of Texas and Louisiana have not been driven by Hurricane Harvey to crime. They've been driven to generosity.
Interesting observations. Thank you so much, Howard. Gasoline futures surged to another two-year high, and crude oil fell as flooding and damage from Tropical Storm Harvey shut nearly a quarter of U.S. refinery capacity, curbing demand for crude while raising the risk of fuel shortages in the future. Another tropical system forming in the eastern Atlantic Ocean. Just as Tropical Storm Harvey moving into Louisiana after dumping record amounts of rainfall across Texas, the National Hurricane Center said that Tropical Storm Irma is located about 420 miles west of Cabo Verde Islands and is moving west at about 13 miles an hour with 50-mile-an-hour winds there. The U.S. economy growing faster than initially thought in the second quarter, notching its quickest pace in more than 2 years, and there are signs that the momentum was sustained at the start of the third quarter. That's good news. The U.S. Missile Defense Agency has announced that it successfully shot down a medium-range ballistic missile off the coast of Hawaii in a new test of its missile defense system at sea. The USS John Paul Jones, that's a guided missile destroyer, successfully launched an SM-6 interceptor missile to shoot down the target. But there's still problems with North Korea. Let's check in with author Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. I don't know, John, what's your guess on Korea? This thing is still strange to me.
Well, there's a lot of moving parts to it. I mean, you've got Sergey Lavrov in Abu Dhabi yesterday, who said that that Kim Jong-un has to adhere to the UN sanctions, the August 5th UN sanctions, or there'll be more consequences for him. Now, we all know that the UN is more of a debating society than it is, it has some capacity to enforce anything. So the enforcement function falls on the U.S., unfortunately. But what we know is that Kim has shot a missile across Hokkaido, Japan. Their sirens went off. There was panic in the streets. They were emailing citizens on some kind of an email, warning system, to take cover. And this is as close to an act of war as you can get. Now, Kim is very clever because he knows that firing a missile over a country is not a missile in a country. So, the criteria that I think the Trump administration is using is that if he attacks or threatens a U.S. ally, then the trigger is going to occur for some dire consequences. But as of right now, I mean, we saw him back off at least for a few weeks. And then, with this new missile launch. Now, today, he said that the intercontinental ballistic missiles and the intermediate ballistic missiles that he has are a prelude right now to containing Guam. So he's renewing the threat against Guam. So I think, that he's pushing this to the brink right now. And there is some movement, I think, from Russia and from China putting pressure on him to stop firing off these missiles. But that doesn't deal with the real issue that confronts the United States, and that is the development of an ICBM that's nuke-ready by North Korea. No one really knows when that is going to be ready. So and threatening, the homeland, mainland of the United States, and then bases in Asia. So I think the situation right now is not imminent for a U.S. attack. There was a report, I don't know if you caught that, Stephen Bannon, when he was at the White House, said that Trump's fire and fury comments were a bluff. But I don't know how much of a bluff it can be when the Defense Secretary, Mattis, says the day after that if Kim doesn't cease and desist, that regime change is on the way in North Korea and the destruction of the North Korean people. So I think this is real. I don't think it's a bluff. I think the idea that some optimists, maybe some very naive people have in this situation is the war on the Korean Peninsula is unthinkable because of the assets that are in South Korea in Seoul. And I just think that this is real. You had the South Korean president, who was a very peace-oriented sort of guy. This is Moon Jae-in. And he said that he ordered his generals, basically, to come up with a decapitation strike for a potential regime change in North Korea. Now, that's coming from somebody who just a month ago was talking about potential meetings and negotiations with North Korea. So I think this is, the South Koreans are very much on the same as the U.S. This is no longer about the U.S. just defending the 38th parallel from a North Korean invasion. This is about the North Koreans developing a nuclear-tipped ICBM and threatening the United States.
And
so
they
there's
would.
There's a long way to go with this Korean crisis, but I think that Trump seems to be on top of it.
All right, John, we're going to check in with you this week as these conditions develop even further. A 33-year-old woman found with rosary beads in her throat has died in a Bronx, New York hospital. The woman's boyfriend was seen naked in the street shouting about the devil. Police officers tasered him and took him away. Jeez. In a moment, we are going to talk about catastrophes. Can we handle them? Hugh Simpson joins us. His latest book, Disappear and Reappear. And he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Hugh Simpson with us has spent the past 18 years teaching clients worldwide about preparedness and survival. Previously, he was a network news investigative reporter reporting on civil rights in the late 60s and the 60s drug scene and consumerism. After leaving news, he returned to Florida State University to finish a degree in sociology, went on to get a master's in advertising and public relations at the University of Illinois. He's a noted author as well. One of his books, Disappear and Reappear. Hugh, I think it's extremely timely to get you on the program tonight. Welcome.
Hi, how are you, George? It's been a long while. It's been about 5 years.
Yes, it sure has. Almost to the day.
Yeah, to the day. We were doing the same kind of thing with Hurricane Katrina.
Yep, absolutely.
And, at the time, Tim was on. Tim happens to be, if you remember him, was the guy that was a special boat guy from the UK. He's right in Houston right now. He's in Houston doing search and helping in that area. And I was listening to your person earlier, and it's true. I've heard some wonderful stories, you know, black and white, people helping together, no racial divide. But if you look across what we're seeing with Charlottesville and other places, San Francisco, my clients are just getting real scared and saying, how do we get out of the situation on the mainland? And I've been exploring this and have found a few places that they like.
Are we handling, as a government, Hugh, are we handling Harvey better than we handled Katrina?
No question. We're handling it much better. The only thing was is that I heard the mayor say that it would have been impossible to move 6.5 million or how many people are in Houston, Texas. However, I talked to a person who is an expert in that field, and they said, why didn't they think of checking, because they know all the low areas in Houston, why not evacuate the people from the lowest area of Houston when they knew it was coming in?
Right.
That would be the only thing he was saying. You know certain areas of Houston are lower than others. Get those people out so that at least you have those people getting out of the area. And I thought, that's a pretty good idea. You know, and the mayor should, and his staff and his emergency staff should know where the lowest areas are, the worst areas, and evacuate them before you evacuate anybody else.
I can't imagine 50 inches of rain. That would be the equivalent of 500 inches of snow.
Absolutely. It's unbelievable. It's, you know, it's literally historical. And, you know, I'm sure you've had people come on and talk about this, and I've studied it myself. I'm not saying that it happened or anything like that, but we all know that the U.S. government and other governments, including the Soviet Union, have been practicing weather engineering for years. You know, salting the sky or scalar energy or anything like that, you know, or even a terrorist could have set out in the Gulf of Mexico on a 200-foot yacht that no Coast Guard person would have ever even questioned, because they don't question too many 200-foot yachts. They just think a lot of rich people live on them. And they could have done something out there with a scalar device that had caused the problem. I mean, we're living in very scary times, and my clients are saying, what are we going to do?
And this could be a prelude, Hugh, of many other things to come. My biggest concern, and something we've been talking about for a couple of years now, is the power grid that could go down because of an X flare from the sun or an EMP attack from a rogue nation like the nut job in North Korea detonating a nuke high atop the United States in the atmosphere. It could shut down the power grid. I mean, and if that goes, Can you imagine, you know, not just a refined area of Texas, but, I mean, a cross-section of the United States with no power? It would be it would be a horrible biblical catastrophe.
Absolutely. And, George, the other thing is, because we have such an antiquated way that we set up the electric grid, we set it up so that it triggered a domino effect. If we had been smart and studied it years ago, we would have ended that. And literally, I can tell you a story. I have another book that came out called Grid Going Down that's on Amazon right now. It came out about 2 years ago, and it was a story in Oregon. It was just a hot day. The lines sagged on a street, and that sagging on that street literally, if you'll remember, I think it was 1996, cut the power for almost all of the northwest part of the United States for about 4 or 5 hours. And that, you know, the thing today also is that look how much we're overloading the system with, you know, 52-inch television screens and 5 rooms of the house and this kind of thing and that kind of thing. I mean, I go into houses and I say to people, I say, I hope you've got capacity to handle this. They've got so many things electrically going on at the same time. And that's another thing. You wouldn't even have to use terrorism. All you'd have to do is that we would have a huge, you know, situation where it would just snap the entire power system. And I happened to be at Wake Forest in North Carolina in school before I was at Florida State. I was at Wake Forest, and I was there when all the power went off in the United States of America back in the 60s, you know, the big power.
Yeah.
And they shut our power here in North Carolina, where I live now, when I was at Wake. They shut our power so they could jump the power to the other areas to try to get them jump-started. So they jumped us, and we said, oh, it was great. We could sit around in the room with a candle and play poker.
Well, can you imagine what it would be like if the power goes out not just for 4 hours or a day, but for weeks or months at end?
Absolutely. Here's one thing I told people to do in my book, Grid Going Down, to see how well you'd respond. On a Friday afternoon, I want everybody to turn off all their electric power, period, for the entire weekend and see how well you can handle it.
Think, you know, or put your smartphone away for a weekend.
That's right. That's exactly right. Exactly right. And, you know, and not go out unless it's absolutely necessary because, you know, you wouldn't be going out anyway. And because people today don't realize that when I was growing up at the gas station, you could turn that crank and get the gas moving. They're in a place in the world like that. In other words, you'd have to, everything's electronic. I mean, your ATMs, the stores close, the fast food restaurants will close, everything will close because the power has gone off and they will not stay open. So, you know, and unless you live on a farm or something like that or have a nice garden, you're out of luck.
Get yourself a CC Solar Observer from our client, C. Crane, and listen with a hand-cranked radio to our show, because that's about the only thing that'll be available to you.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, we're looking at other areas of the world. We're currently looking at the U.S. Virgin Islands. I'm looking at that because I'm developing a new manufacturing of a thing called smart cell technology, which will allow people to sail a lot easier within, say, an hour's period of time. You'd be able to sail because you're going to be eliminating a lot of the things like the jib lines and the jibs and everything like that. And so I started looking for places to put that, and I know that talking to Lisa, she said one of your people that you had on knows about it, but very few people know that if you qualify in the U.S. Virgin Islands for manufacturing or other areas, and you hire 8 to 10 people within a year, and you also live about 180 days of the year, one half of the year there, you qualify for automatic 90% reduction of both your personal and business federal income tax.
Not bad.
Where do you have that on the mainland?
No, you don't. You don't have that at all.
And then why are we chasing all of our business off of the mainland? I mean, I got right here in Franklin, North Carolina, where I live in the mountains, we've got an industrial park that is almost totally vacant because they pulled out Caterpillar. All those people have pulled out of there because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't stand the North Carolina ways of the laws of doing things, and they went to other areas. And, you know, why are we sending people over to the Virgin Islands for a 90% reduction of their federal income tax? Why aren't we doing that here?
Doesn't make any sense. Hugh, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. And when we do, let's talk about the book, Disappear and Reappear, and just what that title means. Hugh Simpson, our special guest. Next hour, we'll take calls with him on Coast to Coast AM. Well, when I head back to Los Angeles, we've got our special luncheon series beginning again. And our next luncheon will be on Tuesday, September 26th. In L.A. with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, as we talk about all her works, including the Encyclopedia of Dreams. She might even interpret some of your dreams at the special luncheon. Simply send an email with your name and phone number, and they will get right back to you and schedule this. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. It's that simple. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. And welcome back to Coast, and as we were talking, Hugh Simpson, our special guest, will get into his book, his latest one, of course, called Disappear and Reappear. Back in 2003, when we had that Northeast blackout, 10 million people in Ontario, 45 million people in 8 U.S. states without power while that was going on. Is Canada connected to our grid, Hugh?
I don't know, George. I don't think so. I think our grid is... in the USA, but I could be wrong. We could have
They must have been to get.
You're right. It must be that, you know, we should keep our grids separate in at least sectors of the United States and not have it go so that, you know, it domino effects, because that's going to be the big disaster. And like I said, we're overloading that grid every day with all these electronics and toys and things like that.
The book, Disappear and Reappear, tell me about the title.
Well, the idea is that my clients were saying, you know, I'm really scared. I'm really worried about what's happening here. I'm, you know, seeing it, everything like that. And I'm waking up after many years of you talking to me or and other people, too. I'm waking up, and I really don't want to keep my family here. Where could we go? Where could we disappear to? And I said, well, there are some areas I'm sure we could study and find out about, and we could work on that. And even in the USA, disappearing, I was just sitting here while waiting to go on with you. I'm sure you've heard of Bill Bonner. Bill's a well-known financial consultant, and I was just reading one of his things that says, you know, there's still plenty of property in the United States of America. We're talking $650 an acre, $850 an acre, you know, out in areas we may not have all the shopping malls and everything like that, but it's still available so that you can disappear from the urban areas. I lived in Atlanta, Georgia for many years and would never go back. And the thing is that you can go to these areas and you can get away from crime, you can get away from, you know, problems, and you can do a lot of things you want to do without your neighbors worrying about you because you've got about 100 acres. it's really nice. So that's kind of a form of disappear you can do. But my clients are really considering disappearing, and I know... maybe you have time to do it. My favorite channel happens to be HGTV. A friend of mine's vice president of HGTV. And I'm watching, you know, a lot of that because I love watching the renovations and things like that. But I'm noticing, and you may notice it too, look how many families are taking their children out of America to go to Hungary, I've seen, you know, and to China and all kinds of places so they can get away from the Walmart, McDonald's mentality and show them that everything is not instant everything, and that there's a new way to look at things, a new culture. And I'm seeing it more and more on HGTV. I'm seeing more and more people deciding, you know, let's go and take our children somewhere where they can get away from that and see what happens in another culture. And a lot of my clients are doing the same thing with their children. They want to look and take them to an adventure. And one of our other adventures is that, you know, in the last... decade, George, we have doubled the amount of full-time U.S. Americans living on the seven seas.
That's huge. And explain seven seas.
Seven seas means, you know, the Pacific, the Atlantic, the Indian, the all the different oceans around the world, you know, that the seven seas, like you said in old times. But more and more of them are living, and they're not living on 100, 250 yachts. They're living on 30-footers to 40-footers, maybe 50 at tops. But they're going from place to place, taking their children places and educating them right on the yacht and everything like that. And today you can do it with the Internet. I mean, you can just, it's just things that I couldn't do. I'm 71. I couldn't have even think of doing when I was a kid.
It's still tough, though, for a lot of people, Hugh, to just pick up and go.
Oh, it is. It is. It's hard to do, and you better be planning for it, George. You know, it's like you better plan it like you were planning a Navy SEAL mission or mm-hmm. something like that. And I tell people, this is not something that you just all of a sudden say, oh, I want to do this, you know, and some, you know, spur of the moment. You better know what you're doing, and you better study out what you need to do, and you got to realize that it's going to be a total culture shock to go to some of the places that some people are going and, you know, and finding. But most people I've talked to say, oh, man, I wish we'd done it earlier.
You also think that people should choose the Virgin Islands, Belize, Uruguay as places to pop up and reappear. How come?
Well, we mentioned about the Virgin Islands. It's part of the U.S. government anyway. I mean,
right.
You know, U.S. government protected. You don't even have to have a passport. You can use your driver's license or a state ID card, and that's just like a passport. And now the reason that I chose Belize is that I've been studying Belize for years and years and years, and it's one of those countries that basically have told the federal government, look, you know, we were under British rule for over 200 years, and we're not going to let you tell us what to do in our country, you know. And a lot of American expats live in Belize, especially a lot of military expats live there. And, you know, some of the things that you would be extradited for in other countries, you're not extradited in Belize. Now, of course, murder, rape, you know, pedophiles, drug trafficking, slavery, and all those things, yes.
John McAfee, the software, who's a friend of ours,
yes,
he ran into all kinds of problems in Belize.
He did run into some problems. And you know, I would tell people, don't get up on the radar. In other words, they, you know, keep low. That's the other thing we tell people is that, for instance, if you're going to start looking to disappear, the first thing you want to start doing is getting off of social media.
That's the easiest way to find people.
Absolutely. I mean, look, they've got a way on Facebook. It's called Facebook Want Post. And what it is that whatever they're looking for somebody, now it might work out in a good way, a positive way, as opposed to a negative way, but they can put out 30,000 Wanter posters on Facebook into the area that person is, you know, located.
Sure.
And everybody's going to be looking for that person because they're going to be offering an award. You know, and you were talking about, and in talking to me, we were going to talk about the technology. Well, you know, even Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk are scared to death of what AI could lead to.
Oh, they're warning us about AI.
Absolutely, they're warning us. I mean, those are two guys that know more about the Internet, know what it can do, than probably anybody out there, and they're warning us what could happen. And I guess you heard what happened at Facebook. Two guys were working with, they were working with two AI projects, and the two AI projects started talking to each other in their own language.
And there was a movie, just a dramatic movie, of a guy who fell in love with his female-voiced software program. And she had the ability to reason and talk and showed emotion.
Uh-huh.
And it ends with the female software program falling in love with another guy software program.
Uh-huh.
And the physical guy was left out.
He was left out.
It was a bizarre movie, but you know what? A real type movie, I think.
I think so. We're seeing it more and more. I mean, the more we start going and delving into that area, the more danger we run into, and especially when it comes to military AI. military AI could get totally out of hand, and the Russians and the Chinese are working heavily in military AI.
Yeah, they are. I am opposed to driverless cars and trucks especially. We've got a huge truck driver audience, Hugh. They move our country.
Absolutely.
They're employed. They pay taxes. You know, we need our truck drivers. I don't want to see driverless trucks in this country.
No, I don't either. I mean, as you travel, you've got a lot of, you know, if you're on the interstate, you got a lot of truck drivers out there anyway. I certainly don't want one that doesn't have a driver.
No, I mean, could you imagine coming up to a semi, you look up, and there's nobody there?
I know.
It's just moving along. I mean, how does it know when the roads are icy or where it's snowy or in things like that? And then what happens when technology fails or somebody hacks into all these things and creates collisions of biblical proportions again?
Have you read one of Tom Clancy's last books? It was called Threat Vector.
Yes. Yes. And that tells you everything that could happen.
Oh, my God. All those people that are trained in hacking, then they come over to our universities, went to our universities, went then into our defense department, you know, companies, and then all of a sudden disappeared. Talk about disappear, reappear. Disappeared from the U.S. after being trained here, having clearance, and they go reappear over in China, run by the Chinese People's Republic Army. You know, I mean, that's, to me, the scariest thing in the world.
Well, people are going to face, I think, sooner than later, more and more potential catastrophes where they need to take care of themselves. You know, we're proponents of storable food for the future.
Absolutely.
And things like that. But, I mean, Hurricane Harvey was, you know, again, just a little indicator. I mean, what happens if the power grid grows out or North Korea does launch a nuke one day and it hits the atmosphere and knocks out the grid?
Absolutely.
I mean, we're up a creek. They have predicted that 90% of the Americans, 90% will die within a year if the power goes out.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. And the scary thing is, George, we estimate that only 2 to 3% of Americans are fully prepared for anything.
I would believe that. I would believe that.
98% of them have no preparation. I mean,
and of the 2%, I bet 50% of them listen to this show.
They do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely they listen to this show. I mean, you know, you're one of the only shows that's really getting it out there. I mean, I was writing for Survivor's Edge magazine for them for a while. Then they brought in a new editor, and he says, oh, I want you to start writing it like it's an apocalypse or zombies. And I said, let me tell you something, pal. I said, I'm 71 years old. I worked for CBS News as an investigative reporter for them. I am not going to start writing like you want me to write a comic book thing. I said, this is not comic book stuff. This is dangerous, tough stuff. And I look at these reality shows, quote, about these preppers, and where they say, oh, well, we've got all this stuff stored in our basement, 1,500, you know, and then they show themselves stupidly on these shows, and I know about exactly where they are.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? I could pin this team, and then they say, oh, but we've got dogs in the backyard. I can tranquilize the dogs. I mean, this is the stupidest thing. And in certain areas, I won't say where in Atlanta, but there are certain areas of Atlanta, if I pulled up a moving van and was in moving van clothes, and I had a moving van look, and the people next door said, oh, I didn't know they were moving. Yeah, they've asked us to move, and, you know, they're at work, and we're helping to move out and everything. I could move out everything in their house, and the neighbors wouldn't even care.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Hugh Simpson with us. We're going to take calls next hour with Hugh as we talk about preparedness and places to disappear and just to get your views on some of the things we're talking about. Hugh, I've got to ask you, when you were working with CBS, you know, covering civil rights stories, incredible stories, what a time period for the United States. Did you get a chance to meet Walter Cronkite?
I did. I met Walter later on. I met Walter, Uncle Walt, we call him, and he was the greatest guy in the world. He was a sailing fanatic, and he really loved to sail. And you were talking in your break about, you know, you're not taking it from the conservative or the Democratic or the liberal or that side or whatever. And that's when I was in news, We didn't have this thing about us as reporters trying to tell the audience what we thought about it.
Exactly.
We would have never thought that in a million.
Oh, my God. It would have been a cardinal sin.
Well, I didn't fire. You know, you didn't say anything about the way you felt about it.
We had a department at our television stations. I worked in Detroit and St. Louis and Minneapolis. I had a CBS station in Detroit, WJBK, at the time.
Oh, my God, you worked at JBK?
Oh, for years.
Oh, my God, Jim Lina.
You're kidding.
Jim was my general manager.
That's a small world. I was there from 74 to 78.
Oh, my God. In 78, George, we were there with I handled the Marlboro Man. I was his publicity agent, okay? He came to your station. We came there.
You were on a morning show with our host, Vic Caputo.
That's right, and she had never ridden a horse.
That's amazing.
And he was outside there on that ice with a $500,000 horse.
What a beautiful local station, too, wasn't it?
Beautiful station. And in walks this guy, and I said, oh, my God, you're Jim Lina, aren't you? We used to call him Hatchet Man Lina.
Huh.
I said, oh, my God, they got you up here now.
That's something. Oh, my gosh.
How about that?
I was born in Detroit. My whole career was there for years, and then I left to go to Minneapolis and then St. Louis and then dabbled.
KMOX?
I did some work at KMOX, KTRS. I'm on 97.1 in St. Louis now, and, of course, we're on 620 radio stations. But,
yeah.
God, had just a great, great time in news. But it was different then.
Yes, it was. George, we've lost all our great news people. And as Ted Turner said, and he put it so bluntly, as he always did, because I got to know Ted, he said, let me tell you what I think news is. It's a bunch of blonde-haired, blue-eyed girls and boys bubble their head up and down and look at a teleprompter.
You know, the last of the good ones, and he got caught up in a mess, was Dan Rather.
That's right. Dan got caught up in a mess, and then we just had Schieffer retire from CBS.
Yep.
One of the last great ones.
One of the last good ones, absolutely.
One of the last good ones, but, you know, it's today. It's a bunch of kids. They go to theater school, a lot of them, you know.
Were you covering civil rights when Martin Luther King got assassinated?
I was in both Florida and Georgia, and my biggest story was at 23, they sent me to Waycross, Georgia. And the Klan was marching on one side of the road, and the marchers were on the other side of the road. And I was 23 in the middle of the road and saying, what am I doing here?
What times?
Oh, my God.
You know, the tenseness of what happened then is still around today.
Yes, it is. And, you know, we saw that in Charlottesville.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
We're seeing it in other places, and that's what's scary to me. I mean, it's really scary. We're beginning to see what we saw, George, in the 60s recurring again, and that cycle is scaring me to death.
And when were you in the public relations field? What was your
time? Public relations field. I graduated from the University of Illinois in 1973, and I went into the public relations field, and I went back home, and I opened my office there, and I had a couple of World Guinness record holders and all kind of crazy people, and went to New Orleans for a college thing when they used to have a thing where you'd bring your clients and they'd I forgot what they call it, but you know, colleges have their programs,
orientation like programs and stuff. We're going to come back in a moment, Hugh. We'll take phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM.